You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. We're in the middle of a record-breaking surge of COVID cases, and one doctor says how much virus is in the community should guide our actions.
How high is the circulating virus in the community? When the test positivity rate was like 1, 2%, you can behave yourself a little bit differently. But when it's 15, 30%, you need to behave yourself with caution.
She says we need to fundamentally transform our systems and ways of doing things to ensure that people can protect themselves. That also means shifting our mindsets, because she sees stigmatization of people who have to risk exposure.
I remember the beginning of the pandemic, a friend of mine saying that they were going to have dinner with some friends. And I said, really, you know, movement of people is not a good thing right now. And the response was, oh, we know them really well. They're clean.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic.
Thank you. And good morning, everyone. And thank you for being here today. Today, as we continue to see our COVID cases reach record levels, our seven-day case rate is 1,386 new cases per day. And while this is very challenging, I can only imagine what we would be saying if we were seeing these case numbers before we had the vaccine.
That's Mayor London Breed giving an update about the coronavirus situation in San Francisco on Tuesday, January 11th. Here's the city's director of health, Dr. Grant Colfax, with some more numbers.
We are continuing to see an unprecedented number of COVID-19 cases, far outpacing any other previous surge, with more than 149 COVID-positive cases per 100,000 people here in San Francisco. And just to put that in perspective, our prior highest surge numbers were about 42 per 100,000. Broken down further, it's an average of about 1,250 San Franciscans per day that are testing positive for COVID. And right now, nearly one in five tests are positive. And it is likely that that rate will continue to increase over the next few days.
As you heard the mayor say, the city is shorthanded on a lot of fronts. Hospitals are pressed for staff, as are schools, and there have been outbreaks in homeless shelters too. Given that situation, we thought it might be time to check in with one of the doctors who's been fighting COVID at the community level about how to respond. The surge affected this show, too. We had originally intended to speak with two doctors, but then one of them actually got COVID. It's been tough for healthcare workers. But Dr. Kim Rhodes says she's ready to keep fighting.
I am refreshed. I just took a break over the Christmas holiday. And so I'm feeling energized and ready to do more battle with COVID while trying to also help people think about how to move forward where we are, how to get present and be here now.
Dr. Rhodes is Associate Director for Community Engagement for the UCSF Cancer Center and also the founder of Umoja Health, which is a COVID-19 testing, vaccination, and wraparound services collaborative. She's also Associate Professor of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UCSF. Can you talk a bit about what getting present and being here now means with the current state of affairs?
I think what it means to me is that we have had what I call a cloudy crystal ball. We've been making predictions about what intervention is going to get us, quote, back to normal. And I think we're at a point where people's mental health is frayed and frazzled because we've taken them up with exciting expectation around vaccination. And now we're having to help people ease on down in the disappointment of another surge. We saw the same thing just before Delta, after, you know, coming down from the peak in January of 2021, and people were starting to feel comfortable because we had vaccines and you could see a drop in the infection rate and the circulation of virus in the community that seemed to correlate with vaccination. And then we got Delta. And so I think taking people up and down on these highs and lows and expectations that look toward getting to normal are failing to recognize that what's happening while we're chasing normal, which is people's cancers are advancing. People's high blood pressure is causing damage to various organs over time. People's risk of having other poor health outcomes are worsening because we're so focused on getting back to normal with COVID. And so I think what we've got to start to do is help people think about how they can shift the way they do things that they used to do pre-COVID, so that we can get some of that done while we're in COVID. Because other diseases aren't waiting. Just because COVID is here, cancer doesn't go on pause.
Yes, and that's a difficult thing, I'm sure, to manage and balance while, you know, hospitals are short-staffed because of this latest spike in cases, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What are some things that we should be thinking about doing differently now that still need to get done, COVID or no?
Well, the things that are really easy for us to understand and to plan for is how we can start to get people screened for cancers and assess their risk for different health outcomes based on helping to manage chronic diseases. Mm. Those are the easy things. I think the harder things are the transformational things that need to happen. For example, this dichotomy between kids need to be in school all the time and their social development and emotional development is suffering because they've been out of school. You know, balancing that against the risk of COVID. The reason we're stuck in this kind of no-win situation, right? Having them in school puts them at risk for getting COVID and the teachers for getting COVID, but then having them out has this impact on social and emotional. We need a different model. And I'm sorry, what I also didn't mention is having them out means that parents have to stay home. Right. Some parents can't stay home. So we need new models of, I don't want to call it school, I'm not sure exactly what to call it, but we need some transformational models where you have small cohorts of students whose parents can't stay home or who don't have access to internet or who don't have computers to be able to come to a COVID-safe environment with small numbers of people where they can participate in online schooling. This is just one idea of what would be transformational because they're not in school, right?
Right.
But they're not out of school in the ways that being out of school are causing harm. You still get to be around a few people. Your parents can still go to work and you have internet access. So we need to start to think differently about how we live now in these current circumstances.
As with any statistic, there's a lot of nuance beyond the eye-popping spike in COVID case counts. Hospitalizations are not spiking as severely as case numbers, though hospitals are strained by staff shortages. But again, nuance.
I mean, it's another place where I think we're running into trouble because we have kind of this false dichotomy between sort of healthcare and public health. Mm. The huge spike in cases, I don't want to say is anybody's fault, because once we start getting into like who's not behaving appropriately, then there's stigma around getting COVID as if you didn't do something right.
And so much shame.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can even feel that for myself, running the kinds of work and operating the kinds of service delivery that we do. You know, we talk about the fact that we've done over 100 events and that none of our staff have gotten COVID, our volunteer staff, no one's gotten COVID. So we're celebrating that, but then it sort of means if somebody does get COVID, then we'll be really sad.
And, yeah. Right?
And like, did we do something wrong? So I don't want to frame it that way. So what I want to say is the spike is nobody's fault.
Mm.
This particular, and I don't even want to say Omicron, because I think that's part of like how we're not setting expectations appropriately. It really is about whatever is circulating right now. Whether it's Omicron, whether it's Delta, whether it's back to good old Alpha, the virus is spreading like wildfire right now. And that does have a negative impact on our healthcare systems. That's where we started with flattening the curve, et cetera. And why we're not doing that now, I don't completely understand, except that I think we want to give people, again, the happy something to look forward to, that we're going to get back to normal. So if we can just keep working through this, then nothing's wrong. Or you should feel like we're okay, because we've got, you know, we've got vaccines and we've got treatment and we've got monoclonals and we've got our new antiviral pills. So I think that part of the problem is the framing, is that it's so difficult to be uncomfortable that we don't want to say, you know what, right now the virus is circulating at such a rate that we need to press pause. And we need to take a break in business as usual, because business as usual is helping this particular mix of variants that are circulating. It's giving them an advantage. And part of it might not be just the movement of people, but the nature of spread, which we've also done a poor job in the messaging of saying it's airborne. So people may be getting infected in ways that we don't really have well described yet. Right. So it's unclear how to protect yourself besides to stay home and to take a pause. But nonetheless, because we don't want people to be disappointed about having to take a pause because they have COVID fatigue, we just go on as business as usual, which then exacerbates the peaks.
Yeah. I mean, isn't there also an element here of people just not being able to not go to work? Like, they can't miss work.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's where we need transformation and innovation. Why do we have a society that requires a certain class of people to do the kind of work that allows the, as we say, they're essential workers because they keep everything else running? Well, they're also people too.
Right.
So I feel like that's to be blamed on our, you know, our political economic system, that it relies on some people really bearing a huge share of the burden of the work that it takes to make the country run as, you know, like normal, with air quotes.
And of course, those workers are struggling with another crucial part of pandemic response, knowing whether they've been infected or not. At-home COVID tests cost in the neighborhood of $10 apiece, and most drugstores are sold out. Lines at testing sites are stretching around the block, and results are taking longer than usual to process. Teachers with United Educators of San Francisco, the teachers union, put on a press conference to call for more tests.
It is important to have a plan in place moving forward and to have an emergency plan in the event that another such surge occurs. Distributing these test kits now is only the beginning of a process to keep schools safe. Now the district needs a written plan for dealing with adults and students who have already become infected, including a state-to-test type of protocol, and personnel to handle contact tracing and other ways to contain the spread that's currently existing.
That press conference was held on January 5th. The week after, on the 13th, the district and the unions representing its workers came to an agreement about how to address the surge. It guarantees N95, KN95, or KF94 masks for school workers and students. It also guarantees weekly testing at all district sites for all students and staff who ask for it, and 10 days of supplemental paid sick leave so staff who test positive or have symptoms can stay home. Teachers had been demanding this, in particular better PPE, along with testing. Health experts have been cautioning that the surgical and cloth masks don't do as good of a job at protecting people from getting infected as N95, KN95, and similar respirators. Now that we're seeing shortages in testing, and how expensive it can be to keep up an adequate supply of the higher performing masks, we can see how focusing too much on just one aspect of prevention can be detrimental.
The reality is, the way we've responded to COVID over time is almost like we can only do one thing at a time. So we started with testing, which was, you know, scarce. And then once it was reasonably, you know, readily available, we got started to really commit to testing and contact tracing. And then once vaccines came, we're like, testing, schmesting.
Vaccines for everybody all the time.
Vaccines
only vaccines matter.
Everybody. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so now here we are, where vaccines, that was going great, but, you know, maybe we're just being fooled by the cycle of the virus because it seems to have a mind of its own. And then we're back to, we need testing, and we're not ready because we didn't prepare.
Yeah.
Because we put all of our eggs in one basket, which was vaccines. So I haven't seen the rebuilding of those networks. I can't say that I have seen community-based organizations who trained some of their staff as contact tracers and case investigators still have those staff working. And so they're able to pivot more quickly from vaccine ambassador to contact tracer than I think the governmental agencies are.
Yeah.
And we've also seen an involution of testing sites, right? There's less testing, more vaccine locations. So again, I think our ability to focus on both at the same time has not been optimal. And I think we're seeing the consequences of that now as the pendulum swings back toward the need for testing.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back to this conversation with Dr. Kim Rhodes, we'll hear more about testing and the danger of putting all our eggs in one basket, plus the fallout of privilege. You've been listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. Depending on what medium you're listening to this program in, you might not be familiar with the different ways that we put the show out into the world. So I want to take this opportunity to tell you about KSFP LP, our broadcast home. This is a low-power radio station at 102.5 FM on the dial. We share the signal with our sister station, KXSF, or San Francisco Community Radio. From 4 to 10 a.m. and 4 to 10 p.m., we broadcast a mix of original work, partner programming, and locally made shows that started as podcasts that we've adapted to the radio format. Then we hand things off to KXSF for the music. The San Francisco Public Press, our parent organization, is a nonprofit newsroom. You can find article adaptations of our shows and work from other reporters, plus ways to support us, at sfpublicpress.org. Let's hear more from Dr. Kim Rhodes with UCSF's Cancer Center and founder of Umoja Health about this massive coronavirus case spike and how we should respond to it. Can you talk about the effects that you're seeing of the shortage of testing in the communities that you work with?
I think the feeling that I have is like there's a desperation. I think people are feeling afraid, and it's a combination of things. People are feeling afraid. People are having their flu-like symptoms or allergy-like symptoms, which may or may not, because it is this time of year, so they want to know. People are being exposed because so many folks have tested positive. And so what you're seeing is this mad rush. And then there are the people who are just like, I just want to know how I'm doing. Oh, and I'm sorry, one last category, the people who don't want to get vaccinated, who therefore have to test every week for their job. So it's this mad crush of people trying to access what is a limited resource. And it happened to fall in a time when a lot of these testing operations shut down for the holidays, which I don't think anybody anticipated. I don't think anybody really thought about, like, what kind of impact is that going to have as CDC shortens the isolation time and then says, like, what you've potentially got to do on the tail end of that is some testing, right? Then you increase in another influx of people into the testing system, and then the place is shut down because the people who have been working these sites are tired and they needed a vacation just like everybody else. So tons of calls across Christmas to, you know, New Year's. Where can I get tested? Are you guys testing? And what I'm trying to get across about the limitation on the resources is, even for us, when we wanted to say to our partners who test with us all the time, sure, I can drive down to the lab and grab a saliva kit for you right now, but there's nobody doing PCR in the lab, so it won't get run, right? So there's like a supply chain behind all the testing that isn't transparent to the people who are in a panic because they're being told they need to test, or they feel symptoms they need to test, or they've been exposed they need to test. And I think that, again, having everybody understand where are these supplies coming from, I think would help people understand or make decisions about, do I need to go out and stand in the line for 3 hours? I have symptoms. Maybe I should simply isolate, or maybe, I mean, quarantine.
Yeah. What do you tell people and community partners who are desperate for tests?
First of all, we try to, you know, stratify like the risk, right? Have you been exposed? Then yeah, if you're day three, day five, you do need to test, right? But if you're just a worried well person, I would say, please stay home because, because you're out there in the line with, right now at our testing sites, one out of three people are positive. And we've never seen that before. It's remarkable. So you're out there really risking getting COVID because the people you're in line with, some of them have COVID.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Right. So the worried well need to stay home. If someone in your family has it that you live in close quarters with, there's no reason to rush out and get a test. Just quarantine. Pretend like you have COVID. Because unless you develop severe symptoms, there's nothing different you're going to do besides, you know, chicken broth and rest and Tylenol. There's nothing special for you to accomplish by going out and standing in the line. But that kind of messaging also hasn't happened. The messaging has been test, 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 everybody test and get vaccinated. Which, by the way, you can't do it on the same day. So
you can't?
No. Oh, we will not vaccinate. If you come to our site and you want to test because you feel like you have a reason to test, we will not vaccinate you on that day.
Right. Of course. Because why if you currently have it?
Correct. Those folks need to wait. So bad messaging not matched with the resources available to actually meet the recommendation. And so, yes, we need to increase testing capacity. We need to keep vaccinating. But I think we also need to be distributing appropriate PPE and actually educating people, because we started with don't get the N95. You don't need it. regardless of what the reason was at the time. And then cloth is fine, and you can use your bandana. So we embedded some messages that are going to be sort of hard to break unless we're really deliberate about it. And I think the way to be deliberate is to be distributing, you know, at least KN95s instead of cloth masks and instead of the paper or surgical masks. So we need to shift our messaging, and then we also need to actually get the materials to people that they need rather than telling them to get it themselves when they're perfectly comfortable with what we told them they needed before.
What does an effective messaging campaign that really reaches the people who need to hear it look like on something like masks, where, as you point out, the messaging from like on high has changed over and over and over again, where it's like, wait, this mask, no, that mask, no, the other thing, no, don't wear one, but do wear one, but only in these circumstances, and you can eat in a restaurant when you don't have a mask on, but then put it on to go to the bathroom. Like, how do we do this better?
Whiplash. Yes. Well, what we're doing in Emoja is trying to consolidate the message. Mm. And so we're effectively saying, we're not talking about which variant it is, doesn't matter. Say, you know, it might be your cousin who doesn't look much like you, but they're still related. It's all still COVID. How do you behave yourself or how do you conduct your business? You ask yourself, how high is the circulating virus in the community? 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, when the test positivity rate was like 1-2%, you can behave yourself a little bit differently. But when it's 15-30%, you need to behave yourself with caution. Mm-hmm. And so that gives people the ability, I mean, they have to pay attention to one data point, which is how much virus is circulating in the community. Are we in a surge or not in a surge? To make some decisions about what they need to do. And the second part of that messaging is COVID is airborne. So that helps you decide what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And when you know it's airborne and you understand this last round of messaging about mask quality actually making a difference, you up your mask game based on the fact that it is airborne and we know that cloth and paper are not the best masks. So when you're in a situation where the positivity rate is low, the base in a virus is low, you might be wearing a paper mask or a cloth mask. And that might be okay because you're not exposed to as much circulating particles in the air. So I think the campaign has three big components. One is don't pay attention to which variant it is. Pay attention to how much of it is circulating in your community. Mm. Number two is understand that COVID is airborne. So then that means you have to mask and you have to think about ventilation. And then as far as masking goes, go back to how much virus is circulating in the community. When it's low, you know, you can go from your cloth mask to your hazmat suit and think about that range of how you want to protect yourself. I think the disservice we really did was the messaging that don't get an N95.
Yeah.
Because it effectively said you don't need to go to that level. But if you couch the messaging in asking people to understand what is circulating around you, then they're going to have the opportunity to go to, you know, DEFCON 5, DEFCON N95, right? And they won't, and there won't be any stigma or I'm doing the wrong thing around that.
I love that. That is now coined. You coined it, DEFCON N95. So thinking of how much virus is circulating in your community, in San Francisco, there have been neighborhoods throughout the pandemic that have been hit really hard by COVID that have had high case rates. Mm-hmm. Well, just recently, the Marina shot to the top of that list, and now it's got the second highest case rate after Mission Bay. Yeah. What's up with that? What, if anything, does this tell us?
I think it tells us something a little bit about privilege, and I think it tells us a lot about how communities with privilege think of themselves as not dirty, not having COVID, right? And we've reinforced that through the pandemic by highlighting poorer neighborhoods or less well-resourced neighborhoods and pointing out that's where the COVID is. See, they have COVID, they're dirty. I'm not saying people actually say this, but I'm saying these are stereotypes that I think come into play here. And I have heard, I remember the beginning of the pandemic, a friend of mine saying that they were going to have dinner with some friends. And I said, really, you know, movement of people is not a good thing right now. Mm. And the response was, oh, we know them really well. They're clean.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And not meaning others are dirty, but like they're very fastidious. Right. So what that's effectively saying is we can do whatever we want because we're not going to get COVID.
We're not like those people.
What my guess is what happened is potentially a lot of travel, right? And populations that could be flying off to take a vacation because I'm sick of COVID and I'm COVID fatigued.
Yep.
And the movement of people is the actual problem.
Oof. So wow.
I suspect it's like the reverse. You know, so the joke we tell about the opiate crisis, right? Mm-hmm. There are certain communities that don't get prescribed pain medication because they are viewed as pain seeking.
Yeah.
But then it lands in another population that gets pain medication because they're deserving of it. So I actually think this is just like a reversal of demographic characteristics and the privilege and entitlement that goes with that.
Her approach is this. If you use simple math based on how much virus is circulating, you can mitigate your risk better than if you focus on other things like which variant is circulating. Dr. Rhodes brought up this example after I stopped recording, but I got her permission to pass it on to you. Let's say you're trying to decide whether to travel by air. When the local test positivity rate is 1%, even if you're only on that plane with 100 other people, more than likely, at least one person on the plane has COVID. But right now, the positivity rate is 10 to 20% in a lot of places. So get on a plane with 100 plus other people, and the number likely to have COVID on that airplane goes up to 10 or 20. Food for thought. And then let's say that you do test positive, like many, 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 many other people are right now. Another message has been added to the mix. The CDC recommending that infected people can end isolation after 5 days if their symptoms abate. I wanted to know if that's had an effect on what employers are asking of their workers here.
Well, I think that workplaces and schools are actually writing their own.
Right.
So people are doing whatever they're told based on their workplace. I mean, I think this has just been a really unfortunate kind of whiplash in explaining something that really may be supported by the data. You know, we haven't seen several papers to support the CDC's recommendation, but you could see how it might make sense. But it's disconcerting because we've just spent a year and a half telling people you've got to spend your 10 days out. Can't come back when you're, you know, still potentially infectious. So one great example that I've seen is Dr. Noha Abalata at Roots Clinic here in Oakland and down on the peninsula wrote guidelines for her staff and incorporating the CDC guideline of isolating for 5 days. And then if you're symptom free, coming back, wearing a mask at all times, literally not allowed to eat in the break room. That means you cannot take your mask off at all while you're on site, and having them do relatively frequent rapid testing before coming into the workplace. And I think that's a reasonable compromise because the rapid tests, the antigen tests, at least can give you a sense of you're wildly infectious, meaning wildly still shedding virus into the atmosphere before you come in. So if that's positive, then obviously you shouldn't be there even though you're asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a nice compromise. That's the one set of guidelines that I've seen get deployed that sort of take from the CDC guidelines and add a bit more.
Bottom line, we have to adapt the way we do things to the changing reality we see around us.
We got to get here now. We got to figure out how, while we solve the mystery of COVID, we have to figure out how we're going to live right now. And I don't think we're going back to normal because normal is part of how we got here. I think the transformational approaches to how we live and work and relate to each other, I think those are going to rise out of this pandemic.
That was Dr. Kim Rhodes, founder of Umoja Health and Associate Director for Community Engagement for the UCSF Cancer Center. She's also Associate Professor of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UCSF. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic. Civic is produced by KSFP LP, a project of the San Francisco Public Press. Our team includes producer Liana Wilcox and contributor Mel Baker, who's also programming director for KSFP. Our theme music is by John Dillon. Lila LaHood is the publisher of the Public Press. Michael Stoll is the executive director. Lisa Rudman is our development director. Noah Arroyo is assistant editor. Kurt Aguilar is the copy chief. Also on our team are photojournalist Jessica Prado, reporter Nuala Bishari, reporter Madison Alvarado, webmaster John Angelico, and fact checker Ambika Kandasamy. Thanks for listening.